Hey, y'all. How's it going?
Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. So,
It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, for the most part.
I need to drink some more of this coffee. I thought I'd had enough of it, but my brain doesn't feel like it. Well, I was having some problems with the chat room, but it looks like it's working again in the different browser. I don't know,
man.
Chrome problems. These things happen, but anyway. Oh, no. Chrome's working. Mozilla's having a problem. Whatever. Anyway, yeah, so there you go. It works. Chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. Oh, except now it's trying to make me do a picture capture, but I can't see what the question is. That sucks. Oh, well. Chat room's broken today, kids. I don't know. You want to chat with me? Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, so Biden, they say, the vice president, is going to announce here in a few minutes whether he's running for president or not. I guess we can assume that the answer is yes, because, hey, a chance at power. What's he going to do? Not try to take it? And especially when the competition is a guy who calls himself a socialist. Not just is one like the rest of them, but is happy to say so. And the other is Hillary Clinton, who everybody hates because she's just so disingenuous and so ambitious, so self-centered, and everybody hates her. She's a very hateful, despicable person, so it's pretty easy to see what's going on there. So Biden's looking at it like, hey, I'm a horrible son of a bitch, but I'm not the most horriblest son of a bitch in the Democratic primaries going on right now. At least by some measures, depending on how you measure it. He's way behind, but I think he could catch up pretty quick. But here's the thing of it. Well, it depends on how the media treats him, I guess. Sorry, forgot to turn off the air conditioner. Hope that's not too noisy in the background for you there. The thing of it is, Biden is horrible. You know, he has that whole Bill Clinton-esque thing where he shakes your hand and acts like he really likes you and makes you like him back or whatever. Well, I don't mean you. I mean a proverbial idiot. Oh, wow, Joe Biden, he seemed to really like me, they seem to say to themselves. So he's got that kind of gregarious, smiling kind of thing going on where he's not just, mean and cynical like so many of these politicians. But here's the thing about it. He's horrible on everything. And he's not just horrible on the drug war and mass incarceration. He's not merely one of the major driving forces behind the entire drug war, foreign and domestic, in Washington, D.C. for the last generation. But also on the personal level, he's a creep. He's always feeling up not just appointees' wives, but their daughters. He's on camera over and over again, sexually harassing teenagers. You know, remember I think the redhead was like 17 or something. This was the new assistant deputy secretary of something's daughter. And he's sitting there grabbing her shoulders and whispering in her ear. And she's going, oh, God. Now, in this particular time, that's unacceptable anyway. Right? That was your daughter. You'd break his jaw. Absolutely unacceptable. But in politically correct times like this, where you can get, you know, I guess if you're a college student, you can be charged with rape for looking at somebody funny. Where, you know, it's life was a George Carlin skit, right? Where it's not reasonable feminism, like, hey, women are people too, but it's insane feminism, like, what you're allowed to say or not say at any given time, according to whoever's whim. And this is PC gone insane reigns right now on the left. Anyway, I think, you know, the right just rejects it and shrugs and doesn't care. But, and I guess they bow down to it in some ways, but, and resist it in others. But to think that Biden could get the Democratic nomination when he's running against a woman and he's on the record being a sexual harasser type and all that, I just, and there's, what, at least three pictures that I can think of where it's somebody's wife or somebody's daughter that he's hitting on, and I'm sure there must be many more than that. And so, more than the fact that he helped Dick Cheney, who he praised yesterday as a decent man who I really like. No, really. Joe Biden said that about Dick Cheney yesterday. Not only did he help Dick Cheney, who he likes, lie us into war in 2002 when he was the chairman. Remember? The chairman, Joe Biden, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The only hearings that were held in the Senate on whether we should bomb Iraq or not were run by him. And of course, excluded any competent anti-war voice, or pretty much any anti-war voice at all, I think. And was just basically a lineup of a bunch of Chalabi front men. I highly recommend to you, if you're near something you can type into, you search Justin Biden, Justin for Justin Raimondo, but you don't have to know how to spell Raimondo. You may know how to spell Raimondo. Justin, I'm just trying to make it simple for you, that's all, guys. Justin Biden, the fix is in. The fix is in from 2002. And it's from August or September 2002, before the UN vote, before the congressional vote. And Joe Biden is holding hearings in the Senate, and only pro-war mongers are allowed to attend and testify. The fix is in for launching an aggressive war on Iraq. And who's guaranteed this fix? Who's made sure that this is going to go off and that Congress is going to vote to authorize this thing? Joe Biden, current Vice President of the United States. But not only that, and not only is he responsible for the mass incarceration, I mean, to a great degree, if any one American politician other than Presidents Clinton and Bush and Obama who have continued to sign off on this stuff and push it and use the rules and regulations and their power as chief executive of the fourth branch of government there in the bureaucracy to do anything about it, it's Biden. From the legislature, he is the one who has pushed this thing. And not only that, he'll feel up your daughter, too. So, what a scumbag. And I think it's the feel up your daughter thing is what's, that's what's really going to hurt him, right? More than him being responsible, as responsible as anyone for the Iraq war, or for the drug war, the modern American national police state, it's going to be the fact that he's a creep. If you couldn't trust this guy around your female relatives, how could you trust him to be the leader of your evil totalitarian global empire? Yeah, you'll notice I don't refer to it as the free world, because it's not. It's not. But anyway, how could you trust this guy to be the leader of your evil totalitarian blood-soaked empire? When you couldn't even trust him around people that you care about, because he's going to put his hands on them. Yeah. It doesn't speak very well to his leadership qualities. Then again, he was a senator, a congressman, then a senator, and vice president of the United States for 7 years now, almost. So, hey, the hell do I know? Maybe if he gets a little bit creepier, we'll make him emperor of the planet Earth forever. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. and I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Me. All right, I'm back. Well, so he's not running for president. All right. He says that since his son died, it took his family too long to get over their grieving before he could run, and now he doesn't have enough time to make enough money to do a campaign, so he's not going to run. All right, well, we already had to suffer through him being vice president, so anyway. All right, now let's make fun of Benjamin Netanyahu for a minute here. Did you see the news about Donald Trump? I mean, well, they have fascists over there. We have them over here. No, Benjamin Netanyahu, well, let me put it this way, has been forced to basically apologize for inadvertently absolving Hitler. Hitler. This is a quote from Benjamin Netanyahu today, Prime Minister of Israel. Quote, I had no intention to absolve Hitler of responsibility for his diabolical destruction of European Jewry. Now, so you might ask yourself, huh, now, what could the Prime Minister of Israel have possibly said that he would now have to backpedal from his absolving Hitler of anything? I kind of can't believe we're having this conversation right now. What's going on here? Well, what happened was, in his attempt to completely falsely and ridiculously blame the Palestinians for the Holocaust, Netanyahu, you know, at least to a great degree, let Adolf Hitler off the hook. From electronicintifada.net, why is Benjamin Netanyahu trying to whitewash Hitler? Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly asserted that Adolf Hitler had no intention of exterminating Europe's Jews until a Palestinian persuaded him to do it. The Israeli Prime Minister's attempt to whitewash Hitler and lay the blame for the Holocaust at the door of Palestinians signals a major escalation of his incitement against and demonization of the people living under his country's military and settler colonial rule. It also involves a good deal of Holocaust denial. In a speech to the World Zionist Congress in Jerusalem on Tuesday, Netanyahu asserted that Haj Amin al-Husseini convinced Hitler to carry out the killings of 6 million Jews. Al-Husseini was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the highest clerical authority dealing with religious issues pertaining to the Muslim community and holy sites during the 20s and 30s when Palestine was under British rule. He was appointed to this role by Herbert Samuel, the avowed Zionist who was the first British High Commissioner of Palestine. In the video above, Netanyahu claims that al-Husseini, quote, had a central role in fomenting the final solution. He flew to Berlin. Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at that time. He wanted to expel the Jews.
and Haj Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? Hitler asked. Burn them. Ali Abunama at electronicintifada.net writes, there is no record of such a conversation whatsoever. And Netanyahu, I would add, of course, provides no evidence that it ever took place. The Mufti did meet Hitler once. Their 95-minute conversation took place on the 28th of November, 1941. Husseini used it to try to secure the Führer's support for Arab independence, as historian Philip Matter explains in his book, The Mufti of Jerusalem. By then, Hitler's plans to exterminate the Jews were already well underway.
I'll continue.
In her classic history, The War Against the Jews, Lucy Davidowitz writes that the preparations among Hitler's top lieutenants to carry out the genocide, quote, sometime during that eventful summer,
I missed a pronoun or some kind of crap in there somewhere, wait a minute.
In her classic history, The War Against the Jews, Lucy Davidowitz writes about the preparations among Hitler's top lieutenants to carry out the genocide. Quote, sometime during the eventful summer of 1941, perhaps even as early as May, Himmler summoned Haas to Berlin and, in privacy, told him that, quote, the Führer had given the order for a final solution of the Jewish question and that, quote, we, the SS, must carry out the order. She adds, quote, in the late summer of 1941, addressing the assembled men of the Einsatzkommandos at Nikolaev, I'm sorry for the pronunciations, I'm from Texas, Himmler repeated to them, quote, repeated to them the liquidation order and pointed out the leaders and men who were taking part in the liquidation bore no personal responsibility for the execution of this order. The responsibility was his alone and the Führer's, end quote. Davidowitz also explains that in the summer, that, quote, in the summer of 1941, a new enterprise was launched, the concentration of Vernichtungslager, the annihilation camp. Two civilians from Hamburg came to Auschwitz that summer to teach the staff how to handle Zyklon B, and in September, in the notorious Block 11, the first gassings were carried out on 250 patients from the hospital and on 600 Russian prisoners of war, probably communists and Jews, end quote. According to Netanyahu's fabricated and Holocaust denialist version of history, none of this could have happened. It was all the Mufti's idea. The Mufti and Zionist propaganda. Why would Netanyahu bring up the Mufti now and in the process whitewash Hitler? The bogus claim that the Mufti had to persuade reluctant Nazis to kill Jews has been pushed by other anti-Palestinian propagandists, notably retired Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, the torture monger. I added the torture monger part, sorry. As Columbia University professor Joseph Massad notes in his 2006 book, The Persistence of the Palestinian Question, Haj Amin al-Husseini has long been a favorite theme of Zionist and Israeli propaganda. Husseini, quote, provided the Israelis with their best propaganda, linking the Palestinians with the Nazis and European anti-Semitism, Massad observes. The Mufti fled British persecution and went to Germany during the war years. He actually spent most of the war years in Iraq. I was reading somewhere else earlier today. And music's playing. Massad writes that al-Husseini, quote, attempted to obtain promises from the Germans that they would not support the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Documents that the Jewish Agency produced in 1946 purporting to show that the Mufti had a role in the extermination of Jews did no such thing. The only thing these unsigned letters by the Mufti show was his opposition to Nazi Germany and Romania is allowing Jews to emigrate to Palestine.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, all Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you?
course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Boy, is it a brave new world we're living in now. Did you see this, guys? WikiLeaks on Twitter just now announce we have obtained the contents of CIA Chief John Brennan's email account and we'll be releasing it shortly. Oh, shit. Holy crap. Now, so it's not his work email. Okay, wait. So rewind a bit. These kids, wait, I have it here somewhere, don't I? Let me find the link, man. These kids, they hacked, they're kids, and they hacked John Brennan's email. I was reading this whole thing about it. What they did was they figured out he was on Verizon. Then they called Verizon pretending to be Verizon, a Verizon worker, saying, okay, so I have this much information, but I need this much more from you. So they got all that information from the operator, you know, the Verizon operator. And then they used that to get the rest of his information from AOL and hack into his AOL email. The director of the CIA has a @AOL email address. And so, anyway, so they figured out all his codes. And he knew he was hacking, and they kept changing. He kept trying to fix it, and they kept, you know, getting him anyway. I don't know exactly how they got it done. But, damn, I had the link here somewhere where they talked about this. And they said that, hey man, all we want is, freedom for the people of Palestine and for you to stop killing innocent people. You know, those are their only demands. Ha! And now, they've given the entire cache of emails to Julian Assange. Holy crap, dude. That is really something else. So, and then, and what they said in there was that they had found classified information in there because that Brennan would forward classified work documents to, or I don't know, classified, but at least work papers must be classified, assumed classified work papers as attachments to his home email address, his regular email address. These freaking guys, this is the director of the CIA? This is his security practices? This is allowed? They don't have an agency within the CIA that makes sure that they have a non-AOL email system going on, even for home use by their highest level executives. Amazing. Amazing. And then, so now what all is in there? I mean, holy crap, who knows? And, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe one argument against the idea that there's a lot of really juicy stuff in there would be that they're gonna put it out this quickly. Because if there's a lot of classified stuff in there that could include sources and methods and whatever, WikiLeaks likes to censor out stuff like that so that nobody accuses them of getting spies killed. So, I don't know. I guess we'll see. I guess we will see. Unless, you know, we have a stealth bomber strike on the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Something like that. Although, even then, it's already backed up on the cloud somewhere, right? Assange would have taken out an insurance policy before he put out a tweet like that. Wow, man. I can't wait. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Syria. What all information about American support for the Army of Conquest? In Syria, the Ahrar al-Sham al-Nusra Front Alliance do we have in Brennan's private emails? And as Obama is pretending to listen to Biden talk right now, is that what he's thinking about? WikiLeaks just tweeted what? They got the whole deal on the Terror Tuesday? So, yeah, man. I tell you what, that looks a lot of fun. Looks like a lot of fun. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention, no interviews today. If you're waiting around for an interview, you can go on about your day. Apparently, I'm not going to have any. I sent a bunch of emails out. I didn't even get any no's. Oh, that's not true. I got a no from Rebecca Gordon. And I had a great conversation with Sheldon Richman. He knows a lot about the Holocaust, but he doesn't know about the Mufti angle on it very much, so he didn't want to come on and speak to that necessarily. So he's just not expert on it. Not expert enough to comment, not yet anyway. But, yeah, I tried to get Nancy Youssef on to talk about this Libya thing. Yeah, we're going to do that. That's going to get a whole segment, so hang around for that. With or without the interview with Nancy, this is going to be good. Even that, even at the top of the thing, they got, "We came, we saw, he died" as the tagline at the Daily Beast, man. All right, yeah, we're going to get to that. And then there's this lawyer Greenfield. You know, I'm worried that maybe he saw my Twitter feed at some point, or even just one tweet of mine, and decided that, yeah, no, don't touch this guy with a 10-foot pole kind of thing. But that's unfortunate if that's what happened, because he wrote this thing that's really important. I talked to you about it back a week or two ago now, maybe. This very important piece, at Simple Justice, a criminal defense blog. Tamir Rice's basically reasonable murder, where he goes through as good as anything I've ever read, better than anything I've ever read, really, explaining how this court decision plus this one plus this one plus this one plus this one amount to a license to kill for every cop in America. There is no official license to kill, but it's just a cumulative effect of a lot of different rulings, basically. And anyway, really great piece, and I really wish I could get him on to talk about it. I haven't heard back from him yet, but I'm hoping that'll happen. Just got an email, told me to go to Mondo Weiss and look at the Gideon Levy speech. Which I was looking at Mondo Weiss this morning, but I didn't see oh man, here's a brand new one by Weiss. Gideon Levy speech. I don't see it on the front page here. Must be here somewhere. Got a link, Bill? Oh, here it is. Facing down hecklers in New York, Gideon Levy calls for equal rights all in one state. Well, how long is it? Oh, part one. Let's see here. Part one, part two. Oh, 3 minutes. That's not bad. 3.5, and then, oh, 15 minutes, and then, oh, see, it's a big long thing. Well, so we're not going to play that on the show, but I will tell you about it. The headline is, "Facing down hecklers in New York, Gideon Levy calls for equal rights for all in one state." I think that's the Haaretz writer, right? Yeah. Yeah, we read him in Haaretz from time to time. Okay, so that's cool. I'll definitely take time to look at that. Thanks, Bill, for recommending it. And that's at mondoweiss.net. Gideon Levy speech, October 19th, 2015. Part one through a lot. Yeah, too bad I couldn't get Leah Bunema on the show today. I sent him a request, too. I wanted to get him to come on and talk about the history of the Mufti and all that and his great debunking, but you could read it at electronicintifada.net. We'll run it on antiwar.com tomorrow. And I'll be right back after this.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, y'all, check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so yeah, the Libya thing, man. For some reason, Robert Gates is out talking and causing trouble for people, which is fine by me, as long as he's causing trouble. One of the things was he was contradicting the conventional line on Russia in Syria, to a slight degree anyway, but anyway. Another thing that he did was he talked to Nancy Youssef, formerly at McClatchy Newspapers, now at the Daily Beast. And I just love this headline, man. I mean, man, it's just something. Hillary's Libya post-war plan was, quote, play it by ear. Play it by ear. Gates says Hillary Clinton still defends the invasion as smart power at its best. But war backers like Clinton had no plan for securing the country, says ex-Pentagon chief Bob Gates. When Hillary Clinton appears before Congress's special committee on Benghazi Thursday, she'll likely be asked all the wrong questions. I love Nancy Youssef. She's great, man. Clinton will be peppered with queries about why she kept a private email server, what caused the 2012 attacks on the U.S. Special Consulate in Benghazi, and how come U.S. forces didn't respond more quickly to the strikes. But the really important issues, the questions long-standing followers of the U.S. and NATO intervention want answered are, why did Hillary Clinton push for strikes that contributed to the fall of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi? And why didn't the Obama administration bother to plan for the all-too-predictable chaos that came next? In 2011, as the U.S. considered intervention, then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was among those who pushed for intervention, without resolving just how Libya would be governed after Gaddafi, according to a senior defense official who is part of the decision-making process. Obama advisors like Samantha Power and Susan Rice also made the case alongside Clinton. They argued the U.S. had a moral obligation to save lives in Benghazi, facing a threatened genocide. That should be in ironic quotes. Maybe Noah Shockman took them out or something. By Libyan dictator Gaddafi, since there was no threatened genocide. It was only completely made up in North America. Well, maybe in Europe, but still. The only strategy spelled out publicly was that the Europeans' newly formed Libyan Transitional Council would be at the forefront of the effort. Washington was, quote, leading from behind, to use a famous phrase from the era. As then-Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who opposed the U.S. intervention, frustratingly explained to the Daily Beast, we were playing it by ear. And, you know, the fact that he didn't resign rather than carry out orders to start that war means that he's a war criminal. He started a war that he thought was not justified. So that's it. By his own definition, he's a war criminal. Oh, but no, really, it's all Hillary's fault, says the Secretary of Defense, who did not quit over it. Isn't that what you would do if you were the Secretary of Defense and you were ordered to start a war that you did not believe was necessary? You just fall right in line and click your heels. Hail Hydra and on with it, right? Or you'd quit.
incredible. Anyway, and the consequences of that improvisation are still being felt today. The country is at an epicenter of the refugee crisis sweeping the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. Part of Libya is under the control of the self-proclaimed Islamic State, and the Russians use the U.S.-NATO intervention in Libya to justify their own military incursions in places like Syria, which, as far as international law goes, they're invited by the government of Syria to attack a bunch of officially American, NATO, and UN-designated terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And Ahrar al-Sham is no different than Al-Qaeda in Syria, so give me a break. And so that's quite different than America attacking a sovereign state over a make-believe genocide that woulda, coulda happened, maybe they pretend. But anyway, but to Hillary Clinton, Libya was and still remains a major achievement. And then she quotes Hillary, so I'll go ahead and do it if I got it, if I could find it. Where is it? Well, I guess not. Where is my Hillary killing Gaddafi quote anyway? Hillary, oh, yeah, here we go.
We came, we saw, he died.
Okay, sorry. October 2001. Smart power at its best is how Clinton described it during the most recent Democratic debate. Clinton campaign aides note she spent months working with the Libyan parliament to craft a successful state in both the run-up to the American intervention and afterward. Oh, really? She spent months working on the regime change before it happened? I thought it was an emergency response to a pretended genocide. Huh. All while honoring a Libyan request for limited Western intervention. A Libyan request meaning Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Sharia, and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, their request for limited intervention, like send your entire air force to fight for us, please, thank you. Huh? Above all else, the aides, and that's not Nancy I'm criticizing, that's the campaign aides she's quoting here, completely full of it. Above all else, the aides stress, the U.S. had a moral obligation to act in Libya. The alternative was so bleak, we simply had to take action, one aide to the Clinton campaign told the Daily Beast. Well, that's funny because it's not true. It's not true at all. And you can read, now I forgot his name all of a sudden. The guy that debunked it in Boston.com. Anyway, you can read Kelly Riddell in fact, this is a much better source. Kelly Riddell in the Washington Times. And yes, they've done a lot of crap on Benghazi, but this is a really important 4-part series that they did on the entire Libya war. And in Kelly Riddell, and I forget her co-author's name, but he co-authored it with her, in their piece, and I interviewed her about this, the DOD and the CIA did not believe in the threatened genocide. They thought the whole thing was bogus. It wasn't threatened. And the proof was that Gaddafi had already attacked and defeated the opposition in 3 or 4 cities before he ever got to Benghazi. And he hadn't killed every man, woman, and child in those cities. When he was saying, hunt down and kill the rats or whatever it was the quote, he was talking about the fighters. He never implied for a minute. Give me a break. That's so stupid. Never implied for a minute, oh yeah, he's going to kill every last civilian in Benghazi. What a stupid lie. You know, at least when Hillary Clinton's husband lied us into war in Kosovo, he pretended that 100,000 people had already been killed, which was a ridiculous lie. And at the end of the war, it was about 6,000, and they were all fighting-age males, virtually all of them. And the super majority of those had been killed after the American war started. But anyway, at least he was pretending something had happened already. In this case, they're saying, oh, we promise this is what's going to happen if you don't let us start this war. And that was good enough. In fact, Americans didn't even care. Nobody was even paying attention. 2011, bomb Libya, whatever. I don't know. That was the American consensus on Libya. Whatever. President Obama wasn't as hawkish as Hillary, though, reads Nancy Youssef again here in the Daily Beast. President Obama, however, didn't quite see things that way. He was reportedly reluctant about the operation until Clinton, Rice, and Power swayed him over Robert Gates' objections. And this is elsewhere reported as well. Quote, Clinton won the bureaucratic battle to use DOD resources to achieve what's essentially the State Department's objective, Steve Clemens wrote in Foreign Policy. That's Steve Clemens from the New America Foundation. And that's also reported by Josh Rogan, had a story about how literally you had the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on one side saying no war. And then you had Hillary, the Secretary of State, Susan Rice, who at that time was the ambassador to the UN, or no, I guess, yeah, I forgot. Anyway, it was Rice, Power, and Clinton on the other side. And Obama chose the women civilians over the military leaders who said, don't do it. Anyway, go read Nancy Youssef in the Daily Beast today. Play it by ear. The aftermath, well, play it by ear. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Back to this Libya thing in a minute, because I ain't done with you and this Libya story yet. What a great story. I love Nancy Youssef. She's such a great reporter. Even when she's over there at the Daily Beast with the bad guys. Still doing great work. First, I got to say this. Thank you to everybody who donates to help support this show. And the rest of you, you could help too. And every little bit helps. And just a little bit times a few equals quite a bit. So, go to scotthorton.org/donate. You can do a one-off donation of a dollar or five or ten or 20 or a thousand or, yeah, right, whatever you want. They're at scotthorton.org/donate by way of PayPal. You can sign up for weekly or monthly donations. There's one guy who gives a penny a week. Hey, thanks. That's pretty good. There are others, there are a couple that do a little bit per week. Mostly they do monthly, but you can choose. And again, every little bit helps. So I'm perfectly grateful for every little bit. Don't think, I can't really do enough to make a difference, because, yeah, it's the multiplication that makes the difference, man. And it's the many. You could also advertise on the show. In fact, I got a book I got to read real quick, and then I think I'm going to sign this guy up as a new advertiser. I read some of his articles, and they were really great. I like that, not just agreeing with somebody, but being entertained by their prose, too, you know? Some good writing from time to time. Wouldn't that be nice? So, looking forward to getting into that book and signing up a new advertiser there, if I can. And, that goes for the rest of you too, man. You got something to sell. You got a business. You got a nonprofit group. You got a thing you want to advertise on the show, help support the show. Again, every ad that I sell helps keep this show going. I should do better at the shtick. I should bring on Palast and have Palast give you a lecture about 4,000 interviews. You gotta help Horton get to 4,000 interviews. He's really good at that kind of thing. Donate to Scott Horton, I tells you, he would say. And yeah, that's it. I mean, assuming I can get anybody to do the show the rest of this week. Oh, did I mention Will Grigg's going to be on the show tomorrow? Will Grigg is going to be on the show tomorrow. But yeah, assuming I can get some people on the show the rest of the week and no big hiccups next week, then I should get to 4,000 interviews next week. Right up there in the, 3,990s right now. In fact, I should check, because I'm not very good at checking at, you know, the mathematics and the addition and subtraction and things here. But I think, yeah, it must be low 90s right now. Hit that button there and see what it says. Anyway, so yeah, man, help the Scott Horton Show get to 4,000 interviews. And yeah, I know, they're all of Gareth Porter and Phil Giraldi and Eric Margolis, but ain't that who you guys want to hear? Because that's who I want to interview. Yeah, see, low 90s right now. 3,991. So should be next week we'll get to 4,000 interviews. So, you know, assuming you're into Eric Margolis interviews, man, wouldn't you want to keep this thing going? Assuming you want to hear from Phil Weiss and Phil Giraldi. Of course. Of course. I should get Ron Paul on the show. Oh, I said that yesterday. Should get Ron Paul on the show to celebrate for 4,000. Get him and Gareth. For next week sometime. Anyway, I don't want to talk about this anymore. ScottHorton.org/donate if you want to help support the show or advertise on the show. Help support your own self by advertising on the show. And let me know. Oh, and there's all kinds of good kickbacks and stuff there, man. If you donate 50 or 100 or 200 bucks to the show, there you get great stuff. So look into that. Okay. According to Robert Gates, Obama told his advisors, this is Nancy Youssef at the Daily Beast. According to Gates, Obama told his advisors that he was 51-49 in favor of intervening. Can you imagine that? Sorry. I just, you know, really? How do you launch a war based on a 51-49 feeling? Start a war. These people are insane. According to Gates, Obama told his advisors that he was 51-49 in favor of intervening. The ratio is telling. According to the New York Times Magazine, Obama was 55-45 about conducting the May 2011 raid that eventually killed bin Laden. And when Obama finally agreed to the operation, he stressed that Operation Odyssey Dawn would be a limited effort to protect civilians from a possible genocide by the Libyan government. Removing Gaddafi was the last thing he wanted to do. Quote, if we tried to overthrow Gaddafi by force, our coalition would splinter. We would likely have to put U.S. troops on the ground to accomplish that mission or risk killing many civilians from the air, Obama said in March 2011. To be blunt, we went down that road in Iraq. Regime change there took 8 years, thousands of American and Iraqi lives, and nearly $1 trillion. That is not something we can afford to repeat in Libya. And then he did it! And I told you, go back and check the archives, man, from 2011. I said, look, if you launch a no-fly zone on the premise that the people of eastern Libya are not safe as long as they live under the dictator, Gaddafi, it's only one step of logic. It's not calculus. It's simple arithmetic. The next step, one step away is, well, they'll never be safe as long as he's still in charge. Regime change. That's it. One plus one. If they declare a no-fly zone, they are declaring regime change in Tripoli. Obviously. The only thing I got wrong was I said, as soon as the suicide bombings start, then America's going to invade and have to build a democracy and purple-fingered elections and train up an army and the rest of this madness. Iraq war, Afghan war style, you know, pseudo occupation and nation building. Because what else are they going to do? Just let Libya go completely to hell? Ruled under the black flag of the Islamic State? Yeah, apparently they don't care. Which is actually, you know what, I prefer them not caring to caring. I'm not saying that. I was just trying to assume the prerogatives of the empire for a minute. And so far, I'm surprised and relieved to have been wrong. I thought that they would have definitely had a huge force in Libya by now. And they must have, I swear, the CIA must have given orders to the American media that, listen, we just don't want to talk about Libya for the next 3 years or 4 years, okay? Just shut up about it. Because there's just been no coverage, and thank God for that. You know, if they told the truth about how horrible it is, we'd be in a worse situation there. That's what I think. Sorry, writing notes to myself for later so I don't forget. So there's Obama. You know what? I should send this to Dan Sanchez for him to add his piece from the other day about Obama and his minions saying all the right things about peace and then doing all their horrible stuff anyway. They're crazy, these people who rule our society. They're just absolutely out of their minds. They're murderous war criminals. Anyway, so attacks spread from the eastern city of Benghazi, where civilians were endangered, to the Libyan capital of Tripoli, 635 miles away. No one ever explained why the change in goal or who might succeed Gaddafi afterwards, except for Scott Horton on this show. That's right. Thank you. Yeah. And I was only right about the first part. During revolutionary era Libya, no one in the upper ranks of the U.S. government seriously considered whether the newly created Transitional National Council, a rival government in rebel-held areas like Benghazi, could govern the oil-rich state. Nor did Clinton or top leaders ask about unintended consequences of an air campaign, especially if it successfully ended Gaddafi's 42-year rule, according to the senior defense official who was part... Hey... Well, I didn't hear the music playing.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Well, I got interrupted by the break there. I didn't hear the bumper music. Maybe I had it down too quiet. Anyway, sorry the chat room's broken today. I don't know what's wrong with it. I'm sure you all miss each other very much. Damn thing's broken, I think. But, you know, hey, I'm going to see if I can get my guy to fix it later. I bet he will. So, yeah, it should be all right tomorrow. Now, look, I actually didn't finish that Nancy Youssef story, but I'm not going to drive the rest of you away with reading it all the way to the end here. But please go and look at this thing. Hillary's Libya post-war plan was, play it by ear, says Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense at the time. Unreal. All right, so now I got to make fun of Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush wrote a thing for National Review. I swear, this guy is the worst at being a candidate. And, you know, I guess I gotta fess up, dude. You know, I guess I still stand by my misstatement. To paraphrase Dan Quayle, I still think it's gonna be Jeb. I don't know. I admit I got a little bit of cognitive dissonance on the thing here. I thought that, that Trump might just kind of flame out here. But, nah, I don't know. I think there will come a time, I explained this before. You look at 1964 was the last time that the more fringe candidate
won the nomination, certainly for the Republicans. Otherwise, it's virtually always the centrist candidate that wins, or one that's just as centrist, Obama or Hillary, for example, interchangeable in 08. But what happened when Goldwater got the nomination in 64 is the Democrats completely obliterated him in a huge landslide. And the lesson from that, according to every political expert ever, is you don't want to do that. You want to make sure that your guy can win the swing votes, that your guy is a liberal Republican or a conservative Democrat right there in the center can win over the swing voters so they can win a bare majority in the most electoral college states, etc., like that. So look at what happened with, oh, we love Howard Dean and all this crap in 2004. They got to Iowa. I think he won in New Hampshire, right? They got to Iowa, and John Kerry said, look, which of us has actually got a prayer against Bush? Me. And the Democrats of Iowa were like, psh, got a point there, blam, and gave it to Kerry. And he came in there with very little support, single-digit support, I think. But he said, look, I'm the Democrat Party clone of Bush, only not as much of a, not as bad of a clown, basically. A year apart from him, the Skull and Bones class at Yale. I think it was 1 year apart. Anyway, so it seems very likely that if the Republican Party can get it through the heads of the Republican voters, that they need the more liberal rhino centrist to be able to beat Hillary, then they're all going to switch to Jeb, because it'll be down to Jeb and Trump by then. Because Jeb's got the money. And the rest of these guys are going to end up dropping out. Rubio and them, they're not going to keep embarrassing themselves by losing. Once it's clear that they cannot be the top tier, they'll be gone. Like Perry and Walker already. Rand might try to stick it out in first gear, Ron Paul style, and just try to stay in as long as he can, hoping that at some point someone will pay attention to one of the PR gimmicks his team comes up with for him to try to pursue. But he's basically an afterthought in this thing anyway. So, but I don't know. On the other hand, I mentioned this. Did I mention this on the radio or not? I forget. The guy that draws Dilbert, which is never funny to me. No offense, dude, if you're a listener to the show or anything, but Scott Adams, apparently he's a really bright guy. I saw his CNN interview, and boy, did he have a lot to say about Donald Trump, and it basically was, this guy's unstoppable. He goes, Donald Trump is showing up to a stick fight with a flamethrower, and meanwhile, all you guys calling the score in the media keep wondering, when is he going to lose? He's not going to lose. He's kicking everybody's asses by a million miles, and they can never catch up with him. Now, maybe this guy doesn't understand the power dynamics of bankers, arms merchants, pill pushers, farmers, Israel, and the other special interests that control the United States of America and its national government, and just how much say over this they have. He's looking at it from an American democracy kind of a point of view, that enough people on the right are going to love this guy. They're going to stick with him. They're going to do it. And he's got the level of celebrity that just overpowers a Clinton and a Bush combined. And, oh, and he talked about how all of his bullying is apt. It's perfect. He picks on them for exactly what's wrong with him. Jeb Bush, I doubt he can even get it up. The guy's low energy. Low energy. Perfect. Fiorina, robotic. Rand Paul, goofy looking. And it's in his eyes, too. It's who he is. He just reeks of douche. And Trump pointed that out perfectly. Rubio, babyface and young first-term senator kind of thing. So he calls him a baby. And so he's not just that it's not just that he calls them names, but he calls them names that stick. You know? And it just works. And none of them have a prayer against them. That's what this guy, Scott Adams, was saying. And I think that's his name. Pretty sure. And, he's got a point. I think it's certainly going to come down to Jeb and Trump. Trump has enough of his own money. But he's a terribly corrupt and horrible person, so, you know, who knows what kind of compromise he'd be willing to make or what, you know, if it really came down to it. But anyway, so I just thought that this was hilarious. I kind of got off the point. Now I'm almost out of time for the segment. And that is that Jeb wrote a thing for the National Review, which, remember, National Review revolt? Like, the entire conservative movement is, you know, basically gone Tea Party and is trying the best they can to divorce themselves from the National Review and from the GOP establishment, from Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and everything that they hate about what the Republican Party is from the people who run it at the top. And then, so what does Jeb do? He runs straight to the National Review. And he says, oh, he blamed my brother for the 9/11 attack. That echoes the attack of Michael Moore and the fringe left. But he doesn't refute it at all. And he gives up on saying, let us look at my brother's great response. Because his great response, of course, was to let Osama bin Laden go. So that he could say, oh, Saddam is tied to Osama, which is not a very good talking point if Osama's already dead. So let him escape to Pakistan so we can take the war to Iraq and kill a million people and destroy all of Middle Eastern civilization. Ruin everything. Get the entire 21st century off on the wrong foot for all of mankind, was his reaction to the attack that he failed to prevent. And this is the fight Jeb wants to keep having. Ha! Bring it.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, Jeb Bush, he said on the air the other day, yeah, Bill Clinton should have done more about Al-Qaeda. Oh, so you are saying there is something that somebody could have done about it before September 11th, that history didn't begin that day, and that it is worthwhile to question whether enough was being done before the attack. But it all comes down to, basically, you are supposed to believe that 9 months is not enough time for the head of America's security force, George W. Bush, to begin doing his job providing security for the United States of America. Oh, he only had 9 months. Now, here's the thing about Bill Clinton. Jeb Bush is, of course, exactly right. And let's have a giant fight about that. Michael Scheuer says that he gave Bill Clinton 10 different chances to kill Osama bin Laden before September 11th. He's told the stories of some of them on the show. And there was actually a letter from a Senate Intelligence Committee report or something like that. What is it? Where they claimed 13. And I asked Scheuer about that, and he said, well, I can verify 10. And there may very well have been others provided by others in the CIA, other opportunities provided by others in the CIA or others in the military. So, yeah, let's talk about how Bill Clinton blamed the Khobar Towers attack, and his idiot sock puppets to this day continue to blame the Khobar Towers attack that killed 19 American airmen on Iranian-backed Saudi Hezbollah. When that's a bunch of crap, as Gareth Porter has proven, as Michael Scheuer is the first one to tell you, it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Youssef's uncle, and Osama bin Laden that did the Khobar Towers attack. Hey, maybe if they had told the truth about that, instead of blaming, you know, who Israel and the Saudi kings wanted them to blame, maybe it would have been a little bit more reality about what was going on by the time of the embassy attacks. Still, that was 1998. What did Bill Clinton do? Bomb the empty side of a mountain, refused to send in the military at all other than cruise missiles to kill bin Laden, and bombed an innocent antibiotics factory in Sudan. Had nothing to do with bin Laden and nothing to do with chemical weapons, as they claimed at the time. They murdered innocent people, the night watchman security guard and others who were working there in the initial strike. And it wasn't an aspirin factory like Rush Limbaugh and all the pretend Bill Clinton critics like to mock and pretend back then. It was an antibiotics factory that was one of the biggest suppliers of medicine for all of sub-Saharan Africa. And tens of thousands of people were presumed to have died or somehow were accounted to have died. And I believe it was the UN that was the source of that claim. Huge consequences from that. And then after the USS Cole, in the year 2000, an attack on an American battleship, what did Bill Clinton do about it? Nothing. And then what did George Bush and Dick Cheney do about it? Nothing. Even after they bombed an American battleship in Yemen, they said, well, whatever, let's pay attention to Iraq only, whatever. Again, this is even the most charitable explanation of their unwillingness to engage on this issue. Remember Hair on Fire? The truthers didn't make that up. That quote is from the head of the CIA at the time, George Tenet, who complained that he could not get his superiors, and he's in the cabinet. The director of Central Intelligence at that time, not just the head of the CIA, but the head of all American intelligence agencies, couldn't get the elected and appointed above him, Rice, Bush, Cheney, to care at all, to pay attention at all, no matter what he did, he says. Anyway, but so Jeb says, yeah, go ahead and examine Clinton, but then skip the first 9 months of my brother's presidency. Don't examine that. The dozens of different warnings that came from the CIA, that came from foreign countries, Jeb says. And he goes, oh, yeah, Michael Moore. Oh, yeah. Boy, you really got my knee-jerk hate response there, except nobody's heard from that big, fat, commie hypocrite in a dozen years. Nobody cares about him. Using his name against people. This guy is so tone-deaf. Jeb Bush is so bad at this. It's incredible to me. Absolutely incredible to me. And then he goes on to talk tough about Iran and their avowed enemy, the Islamic State, and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and the Russians. Let's get real. Donald Trump has no idea what he's talking about. I'm going to take the fight to Iran, Russia, and he says Putin instead of Russia. To Iran, Putin, and ISIS. Oh, I totally can't see what you're doing there. Yeah, because if you said you're going to take the fight to Russia, we might all say, what in the world are these people talking about? Are they out of their minds? Oh, yeah, no, Putin. Yeah, hate Putin. Look, everyone, Goldstein, enemy. Hate him for 2 minutes every day, and you'll just love the state more and more. Devastating defense cuts. Obama's devastating defense cuts. Yeah, right. A couple of hundred billion from $1 trillion a year. And even that is probably mostly bookkeeping and nonsense. He's going to strengthen NATO. And in other words, expanding further into the NATO military alliance, further into Eastern Europe. And repair our alliance with Israel, he says, in order to deter Iran. Oh, and defeat ISIS, who America and its allies have been at least de facto supporting by a degree or two of separation for 4 years in order to weaken Iran. Obama said it himself. Yes, Jeffrey Goldberg, that's right. By weakening Assad, we weaken Iran. It's right there in the Atlantic. So there you go, conservatives. How do you like that? Jeb Bush wants to get your son killed, taking on Iran and their greatest enemy, the Islamic State, at the exact same time. Call it the Axis of Evil. And all the while picking a fight with Russia. And all the while bragging about his brother's foreign policy record. He's blameless for 9/11 happening on his watch, because that's what conservatives believe in, right? Taking responsibility. W is blameless for 9/11 and should be celebrated for his response, which is now universally panned, letting Osama escape, attacking Iraq, and turning the entire Middle East upside down. Don't anyone misinterpret what I'm saying as support for Trump. People always assume that whatever you say, you're taking the other guy's side or whatever. I'm telling you that Trump is an insane, first and foremost, insane, second and foremost, genocidal fascist. Third and foremost, ridiculous person. He's a horrible danger. I would never trust him with power. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I like seeing him fight with Jeb, and I like watching Jeb just lose. Right? He's exactly the caricature that Donald Rumsfeld, soon enough we'll call him Rumsfeld, that Donald Trump needs to run against. He's the perfect foil. This low energy, mushy centrist warmonger, W. Bush defender. Next, he'll be denying the Holocaust like Netanyahu. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Wrapping up for the day already.
It was raining, but it seems like maybe the sun's coming out.
Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So Shell the Richmond has a new one. We'll be running it tomorrow on antiwar.com. It's called, Is Instability the Goal of U.S. Mideast Policy? Wonder. Very important article for you to go look at. I did not have an episode of Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker last night because he was in court and was just getting home when we were supposed to be going on and had a bad day. So there was no Eye on the Empire last night, but, the thing of it is there will be a Future Freedom show with Jacob Hornberger here in a couple of days. What's today? Wednesday? Tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. There will be an episode of the Future Freedom on Liberty.me. Jacob Hornberger. Sorry, I'm just hungry, man. I'm just in a hurry to get this thing over with. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Locals flee as Taliban nears key southern Afghan city. Helmand capital at risk as Taliban gains mount. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. Afghan Taliban forces have been racking up gains in the southeast near Ghazni and still hold some territory in the Kunduz province, though they've since left the city of Kunduz itself. Their latest gains are in the important Helmand province, a key part of the Afghan opium industry, where forces are nearing the capital of Lashkar-Gah. Officials say they're seeing reports of civilians fleeing the city in large numbers, and Taliban gains in Gurshk district have convinced many that the fall of the capital is only a matter of time. The fall of Lashkar-Gah would put the Taliban under control of another part of the key, Highway 1, this time the part that links Kandahar to the western city of Herat. The Ghazni offensive likewise would effectively give the Taliban control of the highway on the other side of Kandahar, leading to the capital of Kabul. A nation with little infrastructure, Highway 1 is one of the only of a few paved roads of import in Afghanistan and circles around the country hitting most of the major cities. Control over the highway's choke points could severely limit the Afghan government's access to the country's south. Yeah, nice war. They say they're going to keep 5,000 there. I think we're going to see a whole new reinvasion. I don't know. What do you think the Taliban are going to do, man? Maybe they're done biding their time. They're ready to get this done right this minute. Or force Obama's hand. Send the Marines back. I don't know what they're going to do, man. Germany, Italy, and Turkey agree to open-ended Afghan presence. NATO general says assurances troops will remain at current levels. Speaking to media today, this is actually 2 days ago, sorry, NATO Commander General Philip Breedlove confirmed that several NATO nations, identified later as Germany, Italy, and Turkey, have agreed to extend their involvement in the military occupation of Afghanistan in an open-ended manner. The U.S. announced last week that its latest pushed-back date for withdrawal was being scrapped outright. An official suggested no new date. General Breedlove appeared to discourage the idea of ever setting a date for a pullout, saying troop levels shouldn't be based on schedules. NATO invaded and occupied Afghanistan way back in 2001, and 14 years in, the most recent UN report has suggested the security situation is worse now than at any point in the entire occupation. That is being presented as justification for keeping the troops around. Yet with the situation just getting worse in the face of a continuing occupation, there seems to be no pretense that a couple of more years are going to magically turn the situation around. And rather, this open-ended commitment is more open-ended than ever, and one coming with no real plan for ever succeeding. You got that right. And now here's the thing about this, man. I was reading some neocon piece of trash yesterday. What was it? Wait, maybe it was Jeb Bush. Did I X that thing out? What does he say about Afghanistan in here? I was reading something where they were talking about... No, it wasn't Jeb. It was something else. And they were saying, oh, yeah, you know, the Jeb... The surge in Iraq worked, and it's really too bad that we're losing Afghanistan when we have the Iraq surge as a model for this great victory. Are you kidding me? First of all, the Iraq surge didn't work, you might have noticed. Iraq is at war right now. And secondly, they did a surge in Afghanistan. We're supposed to pretend that we don't remember 2009 through 2012? An escalation by 90,000 soldiers? For a year and a half? Clear, hold, build, government in a box? The test case, Marja, and then Kandahar? So we can change their entire society. Make them just like us. Stanley McChrystal and David Petraeus going to save the day. Obama, his West Point speech, bowing down. According to Little America, a book by Washington Post reporter, he had a CIA report that warned him not to do the surge because it ain't gonna work anyway. And he knew what it said, so he didn't read it. So he would have plausible deniability. Well, I didn't read a CIA report like that. And then he went ahead and gave in to Petraeus and McChrystal and the War Party for his own political reasons. A war that he knew could not be won. Which maybe you don't care, but that's somebody's kid. That's somebody. Maimed. Killed. Turned into war criminals. Which is, of course, to say nothing of their Afghan victims. For what Obama knew was nothing but his re-election chances. If the Republicans say that I'm a wimp because I ended two wars, how could I ever live that down? He worried. So he only ended one, temporarily, and doubled down, tripled down on the other one. But, oh well, no, apparently the reason that we lost Afghanistan is because Obama is such a feckless, cowardly, I don't know, isolationist, peacenik, Democrat, that he refused to do anything about Afghanistan. Raise your hand if you remember David Petraeus swore to God the Taliban will be brought to heel and it'll do exactly what the hell I tell them to do by January 2011. You have my word on it, Mr. President. Anybody remember that? By July, did I just say January? By July 2011, they're going to be doing exactly what the hell I tell them to do. Said the magical Saint David Petraeus. The greatest general in American history at public relations. But anyway, you know what we should do? We should raise a conscript army of 1 million Americans to go over there, occupy the entire country all over again. And then, I don't know, maybe just Israeli style. We'll just kill them all. And take all their land and settle it with Americans. What do you think? I know Donald Trump could round up 12 million illegal immigrants and transfer them all to Afghanistan. We'll call that the surge. And we'll just murder all the people who are from there and steal all their property. And we'll call that Little America. Since we don't have Little America here anymore, we'll have Little America over there. Now, there's a surge that could work. You know, assuming what you're trying to do is change their entire society. But otherwise, the Afghans will be the Afghans. And the Americans eventually will go home. But Obama, the coward, just like George W. Bush, has decided to make it the next president's problem. What a pathetic war criminal, weasel, murderer our president is, huh? Scum of the earth. Okay, see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.